paragraph, nature is complex and yet we have to find a key to some perfect unity and fullness. Talking about
so maybe we can reread that paragraph, you think, for this ideal, if you're not sure if you're in.
Yeah, let's reread it. I'm just trying to kind of, I'm returning back to some of the earlier paragraphs and trying to draw the thread. I recollect, I think this is the part where he starts by talking about the power of the individual. He introduces the whole debate about individual life and collective life, and then he's essentially pointing to the fact that there are many kinds of collectivities, and they are all aspects or specializations of the cosmic existence, and that the individual belongs in a sense to all of them. It's a very profound paragraph that came some time back, and yet the individual is beyond all of them, can select or choose and not be constrained by any of these. And then he goes on to talk about that fact of the true contribution that a human being can make to a collective is essentially engage with it at a deeper and deeper level and ultimately be in contact with his or her own truth, the truth consciousness, and try to manifest that in the collective. So community, a perfected community can only exist by the perfection of its individuals. Perfection can come only by the discovery and affirmation in life by each of his own spiritual being, and the discovery by all of their spiritual unity as a resultant life unity. So that becomes the sort of goal of the individual in society. Someone trying to get.
Get on. Oh, is he online? I don't see him, but I can add him. I can try to add him.
Do you see Sitaram online?
I don't. Maybe he has.
So, and then we are at the next paragraph, which was also very powerful, where that one about the collectivity, we discussed the fact how the ideal of spiritual life has veered between these two, the escape from life and the bringing of consciousness or divine life to all of mankind. And he goes through that seesaw to some extent by talking about these personalities, talking about the Gita, about Buddha, about Vivekananda, etc. And then the next one, our nature is complex and we have to find a key to some perfect unity and fullness of its complexity. So here is where we are faced with this complex nature that we have. And this paragraph is about, to some extent, about civilization and the ways by which matter, life and mind have interacted. How there has been a perfectibility, which is a rational perfectibility, that has occupied why the human mind, when you're for the Hellenic idea, and then how that has become more like a ideal of organized life. This part is very interesting because this distinction that he draws between the Hellenic idea and what happened with the Roman, which reinforced or weakened it, he says, with the ideal of organized power, the cult of reason, the interpretation of life by an intellectual thought, critical, utilitarian, organizing and constructive, the government of life. This small part of that paragraph is a very profound insight that has been taken up by some contemporary philosophers, particularly the famous philosopher Michel Foucault has taken up this distinction between the Hellenic and the Roman ideal. The second actually becoming one of using the reason to organize life, and the first being one to ally the reason to the soul or to the individual life, the subjective life, and to make it a kind of individual perfectibility of the human. Instead of imposing it as a collective, a sort of regulatory power, which is what the Romans did, this switch from the Hellenic to the Romans is a very critical one. Because along with it comes this notion of the independent reality of social life that can dominate the individual. And not just through external administrative means, but also through the creation of ethics, of an ethics which is imposed by society, creating conscience, creating subjects. And that kind of regulatory function of the reason working society to organize life, as he says over here, becomes the quote-unquote classical ideal. Rather, there is a distinction because the classical ideal is also applied to the Greek. But in fact, the Greek, that's the sort of subtle difference is in that the Greek use of the mind is allied to the individual perfectibility of being, what Foucault calls care of the soul. The care of the soul, you know, it's a general term. I don't know whether we can equate that with psychic being. We can equate that with the subjective life of the individual. It has to be disciplined by the self. We arrive at our own perfectibility through self-discipline. This ultimately becomes also the goal of yoga. But on the other hand, by externalizing our disciplinary apparatus, we enter into an age of social regulation which operates whether through methods of confession. That's why you see the Christian confession becomes so much of a subliminal presence in the organized state. So state organization in modern times is really a more systematic attempt, a follow-through of what was started in Roman times, and to some extent a displacement of the medieval ages. So this kind of a neoclassical urge to dominate life is also something marking the modern age. And civilization civilization has seen a seesaw. And that's why he points out that in the ancient time, the Romans tried this kind of regulation of life, collective regulation of life using the reason, but came up with a civilization that became effete because too rarefied. On the other hand, there was all this excess in the governance by, you know, the people in power. They become slaves of the vital, while the rest become prisoners of conscience. And so this is the situation that set up, situation that cannot last, and ultimately barbarians came and destroyed that entire setup. And that's, he points to the fact that this kind of seesaw of life power refusing to be subject without its consent to social regulation causes the seesaw of civilization and barbarism. Now, then he brings up this idea about the Eastern ideal, the spiritual preoccupation, discovery of a self and inmost truth of being, and release of man's mind and life to the truth of spirit. It's perfection by the power of the spirit. So this is again a return, in a way, at a higher turn of the spiral to the Greek ideal, which is ultimately geared towards individual perfectibility, self-culture, but now raised to a spiritual pitch. And here he points out that Christianity, humanizing Europe, did so due to the influence of Eastern ideals carried by Buddhism and other ancient disciplines to the coasts of Asia and Egypt. So that's something very interesting, which, you know, we discussed, I think, a little bit. The fact that Christian sort of, I mean, it's also very interesting that Christianity has been so strictly, constellated with the Judeo-Christian tradition, whereas it may be more proper to see Christ himself and Christianity, early Christianity, as being a dialogue between cultures, between Judaism and Buddhism and Zoroastrianism, and I mean, I think yoga in general, all these factors coming together, and Hellenism too, to some extent. All these factors came together in the Middle East at the time of Christ. But he points out that, and he talks about barbarism which came and subdued that that move, because it wasn't sufficient. And then he brings us to the modern age, where there is another more systematic attempt to regulate life, now by the power of science, technology and industry. And this is what he says: what the modern spirit has sought for is the economic social ultimate, an ideal material organization of civilization and comfort, the use of reason and science and education for the generalization of utilitarian rationality, which will make the individual a perfected social being in a perfected economic society. So whether we talk about it in terms of capitalism or communism, there is a social ideal at work in both of them. There is an idealism. It isn't that either of them is ultimately just rampant greed, though it may appear so. The notion, the economic ideal of capitalism, of the free market, is actually with people like Adam Smith, who to some extent believe that generation of wealth would ultimately lead to the disappearance of need and the appearance of creative leisure. But you know, the ideals are often very partial, because human nature is complex, as he has pointed out right in the beginning. So we are left with a civilization in which this economic ideal dominates. On the other hand, there has been a kind of sundering between the spiritual life and the material life. And at the administrative level, as well as at the social level, a variety of regulatory devices that have tended to create a systematically uniform world. So here he points out what remained from the spiritual ideal was, for a time, a mentalized and moralized humanitarianism, relieved of all religious coloring. So this cult of the human, of helping others, rather than of expanding the self, or of discovering the soul, or of caring for the subjective life, that gets replaced by this, because nothing higher occupies a society that has defined itself in material terms. And a social ethicism, which was deemed all sufficient to take the place of a religious community. It was so far that the race had reached, when it found itself hurried forward by its own momentum into a subjective chaos, and the chaos of its life, in which all received values were overthrown, and all firm ground seemed to disappear from the social organization, its conduct, and its culture. And we were talking last time about the fact that what he's perhaps talking about here are the world wars. He's writing this around the time of the Second World War, and the fact that all these highly, you know, rational power of civilization could not prevent the ground sort of just tearing open, and these powerful hostile forces erupting below and throwing everything into a confusion. Today we may say that the world war is behind us, but various kinds of irrationalities still roam the world, as we can see, and these irrationalities are garbed in the form of religion. A large number of people are swayed by such forces, because the social perfectibility of the world is not a sufficiently attractive ideal unless there is something in it for the individual. Usually, we are drawn by forms of vital desire and self-interest that, unless they have some other kind of replacement in the intensity of life, it's not possible to substitute these watered-down or lukewarm ideals of a life which is moderate, one may say, just like a moderate collective life, such as one may think of as the communist ideal or a state governed ideal for the masses.
Debashda, did we want to start reading from For This Ideal?
Yeah, let's start reading from For This Ideal.
I can read first. For this ideal, this conscious stress on the material and economic life was in fact a civilized reversion to the first state of man. His early barbaric state and its preoccupation with life and matter, a spiritual retrogression with the resources of the mind of a developed humanity and a fully evolved science at its disposal. As an element in the total complexity of human life, this stress on a perfected economic and material existence has its place in the whole. As a sole or predominant stress, it is for humanity itself, for the evolution itself full of danger. The first danger is a resurgence of the old vital and material primitive barbarian in a civilized form. The means science has put at our disposal eliminates the peril of the subversion and destruction of an effete civilization by stronger primitive peoples, but it is the resurgence of the barbarian in ourselves, in civilized man, that is the peril, and this we see all around us. For that is bound to come if there is no high and strenuous mental and moral ideal controlling and uplifting the vital and physical man in us, and no spiritual ideal liberating him from himself into his inner being. Even if this relapse is escaped, there is another danger, for a cessation of the evolutionary urge, a crystallization into a stable, comfortable, mechanized social living without ideal or outlook is another possible outcome. Reason by itself cannot long maintain the race in its progress. It can do so only if it is a mediator between the life and body and something higher and greater within him. For it is the inner spiritual necessity, the push from what is there yet unrealized within him, that maintains in him, once he has attained to mind, the evolutionary stress, the spiritual nisus. That renounced, he must either relapse and begin all over again, or disappear like other forms of life before him as an evolutionary failure, through incapacity to maintain or to serve the evolutionary urge. At the best, he will remain arrested in some kind of mediary typal perfection, like other animal kinds, while nature pursues her way beyond him to a greater creation.
So we do find this kind of tone in Sri Aurobindo is less, frequent than in the mother towards the end of her life. But we do find off and on this possibility that he raises of humankind being bypassed by evolution, of the possibility that that. Part of this is you remember the line, disappear like the mastodon and sloth from Savitri, that become extinct or become stabilized. This is one of the great marks of humanity, is our instability, is the fact that we are a transitional being. But we can either become extinct or we can become stabilized. These are two possibilities that are, painful, defeats of the evolutionary force in humanity. And he gets to that by talking about these two problems that have arisen. One is that this reversion to a barbaric state, reversion to a preoccupation with the material life and a brushing aside of any higher ideals or of a spiritual goal can either open up a hedonistic and even worse life for those who are in power or have money, and the mass of humanity can be subjected to that, or else they can arise this comfortable stasis, a stasis that is based on the slothfulness of the soul, if you want to call it that, the battening of aspiration in convenience. So this life in which material comfort is universalized, whether through capitalism or communism, doesn't matter, is the rational ideal to some extent, driven to what he has called here the economic absolute, the economic social ultimate. And if that condition is achieved, there is this danger that humanity will either fail as an evolutionary product, find some kind of, you know, sort of ultimately maybe destroy himself through world wars or whatever, or else become stultified as a type of being while evolution moves on into other kinds of beings. In our present age, these kind of more fringe possibilities are certainly raising their heads, and you do have thinkers. This is the entire notion of the post-human, where you do have thinkers that are talking about the emergence of species that might in some way supersede the human. And in what way, we don't know at this point, because things are too uncertain to tell. We have a number of thinkers who are talking about the emergence of new kinds of species out of the human. The whole idea of the post-human is one in which there is the possibility that the human can be surpassed to some extent by his own products. See, whether these may be part cyborg products or genetically engineered products or whatever, that to some extent the human being might become obsolete, might have almost set the stage for his own obsolescence. See? Now, of course, the obsolescence they are talking about is a different one. I doubt any of them are foreseeing that this obsolescence is really one in which the evolutionary urge in the human being lost, that the same will be better manifest in these products that have arisen. But one can never tell. Such a possibility also can arise.
Devashishda, so this paragraph, it reminded me of a thing, and I think it was the Human Cycle, where he speaks of the Philistine and the economic barbarian, the one who has the perfect mix of the current, he's aware of the current mix of ideas. I mean, he goes on a big sarcastic paragraph there. I mean, maybe he wasn't being sarcastic, but it comes across as, you know, like as the situation as likely to be hope. Like, he paints a pretty bleak picture of the so-called perfected man of the time. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
So it kind of seems like he's on a similar vein here, that he's referencing the same category of development, so to say.
Yeah, true. It is similar. But it's very interesting because, you know, the possibilities he's opening up are really all around us. Because on the one hand, the vital life that opens up, because there is no other higher ideal. I mean, consider the possibility that, you know, I mean, if those ideals don't develop, what he's pointing out is the lack of two basic things. One is the lack of moral ideals. Moral idealism was something that governed the ancient world. But again, there, as we said, these moral ideals have become like social ideals. It was not really something higher for which you used morality to discipline yourself. That is the whole notion of the care of the soul. Morality for the sake of the care of the soul, self-discipline, is because there is the notion that we can perfect ourselves individually to reach a certain level of perfection. Spirit, and that can only be if there is a goal ahead of us, an individual goal ahead of us. Otherwise, morality doesn't make sense, and sooner or later we'll flout it. But when you talk about morality as a cover-up for social regulation, sooner or later it comes to a point where you're only looking for a possibility to be superior to it so that you can exercise your vital freedom in libertarian acts. So that becomes a kind of a whole level of barbarism of the vital that arises due to the lack of both moral ideals and spiritual goals. On the other hand, what he's talking about over here is this sense of being sated, the sense that of too long an entire generation of many generations of human beings, see, this was to some extent the Marx's idea, Marxian utopia. The Marxian utopia, according to Marx, and taken up and given form by people like Lenin, was that power of propaganda. First, you equalize human beings. You know, so if you talk about the three great ideals of the modern age, liberty, equality, and fraternity, you take equality and equalize all human beings so that there's no higher and lower, economically speaking, because it was based on material dialectics. And there's nothing spiritual, materially equal human beings. And then what you do is you give everybody the basic modicum of convenience, so everyone has this convenience. And then that's not enough because people still have desire. And though you've equalized them, it's only state-regulated equality, and people are still full of desire to dominate others and have more, etc. So the way you deal with that is through propaganda. You keep telling people how happy they are, how they have all the conveniences of life, how they can't expect anything better than this. And this kind of a life of, you know, mediocre comforts can add up, and also along with the propaganda telling you there is nothing higher, religion is the opium of the people, etc., can add up through the generations to a condition where you ultimately accept that this is the lot of life and we are happy people because we have all our material set of comforts. And that would then lead to a point where state regulation could be removed, because it would become, this is the whole thing about subject formation, the subject would then become crystallized around these ideas, and people would lead an utopic or utopian existence. That would become the social utopia, the socialist utopia. So in a way, what Sri Aurobindo is talking about here, without turning it in this ideological direction, is similar to that. He's saying that for long enough, if whether there is ideology or not, if a humanity lives under the notion that there is nothing greater, we lead a material life, there are no ideals or goals to life except for enjoyment and at the most humanitarianism, then gradually we will settle into this notion that to have a certain amount of comfort of life, which gives us whatever we need and a little more than our just basic survival needs, right? Would ultimately lead to a certain kind of surfeit, a sense of comfort that will kill the soul, that will yield the destruction of the evolutionary nissus. This is the point that he's making away.
when you put the socialist train of thought the way you did just before you spoke about Sri Aurobindo, it almost seems like you almost in hindsight you wonder how could anyone be so naive about human nature. But I guess those were the options. I mean, obviously Marx was a great thinker of the time, but on the other hand, it seems that might have been the best among the choices they had then. But on the other hand, when you put it like that, it seems like that is such a naive way of thinking that, give everybody conveniences and they'll be happy.
Yeah, give everybody convenience and then also do sufficient propaganda to make them believe. It's all a question of make believe. You make them believe that you're happy, right? You keep telling them, "Oh, you're so happy. You're so happy." And anything else you want to believe other than the material, well, that is false. That's an illusion. But look at what you got. It's you're so happy. That's the whole picture of propaganda. In fact, even today, I mean, if you look at the state apparatus of China, the maximum amount of economy, their money, goes into the propaganda department. These people don't realize, but we carried an article about this, that there are some China scholars. On the one hand, all this tremendous amount of so-called capitalist development is going on there. On the other hand, this is accompanied by very strong propaganda machinery, which is going around telling people that you are so fortunate to be Chinese. You're so fortunate to be part of the Republic of China. The sense of pride is being manufactured through a number of means by this department that is actively going out to do that kind of thing. And the whole notion is now it's as if they have realized that what we call capitalism is really a device for achieving the social utopia of Marx, because ultimately it'll level out. And that's what they believe, that it'll level out. Of course, the state will always be the richest capitalist. They'll control capital. They'll be the ones who pump the money into the economy and have these enormous, whatever industries. But on the other hand, what's going to happen is that the comfort zone, I mean, if you flip things aside around from the socialist ideal to the so-called free world, you see the same thing is happening. It without ideology. I mean, the ideology isn't there, but at the same time, it's a kind of a godless world in which people believe that the packaged lives that they lead, which are really being given to them through a variety of commodified marketing choices, is what happiness is all about. This is happiness. Happiness is getting a bonus, going to some mall on your vacation, buying a lot of consumer products, showing others the latest toys that you got. This is happiness, you see. And that's being reinforced not by the state, but by the entire economic machinery of merchandising, by the multinationals. So it's leveling out in the same way to some extent. There is a certain kind of the middle class is getting squished. They're kind of coming into a certain zone, which is more and more people having a certain range, a window of opportunity, which is similar. And that will ultimately be, and so that's what neoliberal globalization is bringing to mankind, a condition which is uniform and to large extent that is giving people the sense of convenience that ultimately makes you feel what more is there to life. See, that becomes the sort of level of happiness. Everybody wears the same kinds of dress, everybody plasters a smile on their face and goes for vacations. See, so that becomes in a way, not state controlled, but the same kind of thing in another garb.
Yeah, the net effect is the same, even though there is no, like, formal propaganda, but it's like there's an undercurrent of propaganda that is that has a life of, I mean, the propaganda just has a life of its own via advertising and implicit social expectations. So it's effectively the same thing, right? Although it
Effectively the same thing. Because as he's pointing out, it doesn't need state ideology to do it. All it needs is first to deny the fact that there is anything greater than the material life and to make that into the vital pull of this existence. And if it's there long enough, then people start believing that and they lead that kind of life and they think, okay, that's all there is to it. Then you tell them that no, there is something else. It's a very interesting thing because, I mean, leave alone spirituality, today religion cannot make its dent on the haves. It can only make its dent on the dispossessed. And that's the people feel that some people like Osama bin Laden are managing to get because there's enough dispossessed in the world that will listen to him. But he can't make a dent on Saudi Arabia, for example, because the average sort of income there is enough that they don't want their life disturbed with all this religion. They want the American lifestyle. So that so-called quote-unquote American lifestyle ultimately becomes that kind of anodyne for the soul inconvenience. Resurgence of barbarianism in oneself is one option he is opening up. The other option he's opening up is the deadening of the soul through convenience. Note that resurgence of barbarism is in oneself is that now you've got choice, right? Like, let's say you don't have any ideals and choice is given to you. You can do what you want. Your buying power has been magnified and you can actually choose. What are you going to choose? You don't have any ideals. So you'll end up choosing the barbaric choices, right? So there begins, I'll choose to become even richer. I'll choose to dominate more people. I'll choose, to spend $1 billion over a house I can show everybody because I make it a gift to my wife, right? Things of that nature are signs of the new barbarism.
Barbarism is typically associated with the unilateral oppressing of others, right? So,
but that is one aspect of barbarism. Barbarism and civilization are two terms that are kind of put against each other. Barbarism is not just oppressing each other. Oppressing other people is one form of barbarism, but any kind of degradation of the urge towards perfection is barbarism. Barbarism can be in taste, for example. Barbarism is of many kinds. Barbarism is a lack of idealism. No, it's a life which is led in the crops of animal life, animal desire, a kind of life which devolves towards the animal.
So I'm just trying to understand that, so can we say that Taj Mahal is an example of barbarism? Barbarian.
No, I wouldn't say that. No, I wouldn't say that. That's actually, if you take it like that, then you can say that the person who made it in his own time is living a certain kind of ideal, because things are different at that time. Now we are living in a democratic world. That in that world, ideals are different. That person is leading a certain life which is constrained by the ideals of his or her own time.
Yeah, I've always felt that issues that, like, the American way is to replace the Eastern search for the self by the search for the perfect sale.
Yeah. Barbarism can, you know, that example that I gave is a certain kind of example. Today it's glaring, right? It wouldn't be glaring in Shah Jahan's time, because in Shah Jahan's time the social ideals are very different, you know. Today it stands out like a sore thumb, because we live in a world where new ideals have formed, at least social ideals have formed. But you know, those social ideals are being flouted completely. So that, in that sense, it's barbarism. Barbarism can also mean, you know, what I said about choice for the common person. The common person finds that, okay, I have choice, you know, to indulge myself in pornography. So, for example, things of that nature, because there is nothing else to do in life. I mean, what else can one do? Barbarism is, for example, the Romans who went to, you know, the Colosseum and kind of watched the gladiators being eaten alive by lions. They got a great kick out of it, you know. They sort of wanted more and more of that.
Lynn, would you like to read next?
Okay. At present, mankind is undergoing an evolutionary crisis in which is concealed a choice of its destiny. For a stage has been reached in which the human mind has achieved, in certain directions, an enormous development, while in others it stands arrested and bewildered and can no longer find its way. A structure of the external life has been raised up by man's ever-active mind and life will, a structure of an unimaginable hugeness and complexity, for the service of his mental, vital, physical claims and urges, a complex political, social, administrative, economic, cultural machinery, an organized collective means for his intellectual, sensational, aesthetic, and material satisfaction. Man has created a system of civilization which has become too big for his limited mental capacity and understanding, and his still more limited spiritual and moral capacity to utilize and manage a too dangerous servant of his blundering ego and its appetites. For no greater seeing mind, no intuitive soul of knowledge, has yet come to his surface of consciousness which could make this basic fullness of life a condition for the free growth of something that exceeded it. This new fullness of the means of life might be, by its power for a release from the incessant, unsatisfied stress of his economic and physical needs, an opportunity for the full pursuit of other and greater aims surpassing the material existence, for the discovery of a higher truth and good and beauty, for the discovery of a greater and diviner spirit which would intervene and use life for a higher perfection of the being. But it is being used instead for the multiplication of new wants and an aggressive expansion of the collective ego. At the same time, science has put at his disposal many potencies of the universal force and has made the life of humanity materially one. But what uses this universal force is a little human individual or communal ego with nothing universal in its light of knowledge or its movements, no inner sense or power which would create in this physical drawing together of the human world, a true life unity, a mental unity, or a spiritual oneness. All that is there is a chaos of clashing mental ideas, urges of individual and collective physical want and need, vital claims and desires, impulses of an ignorant life push, hungers and calls for life satisfaction of individuals, classes, nations, a rich fungus of political and social and economic nostrums and notions, a hustling medley of slogans and panaceas for which men are ready to oppress and be oppressed, to kill and be killed, to impose them somehow or other by the immense and too formidable means placed at his disposal, in the belief that this is his way out to something ideal. The evolution of human mind and life must necessarily lead towards an increasing universality, but on a basis of ego and segmenting and dividing mind, this opening to the universal can only create a vast pollination of unaccorded ideas and impulses, a surge of enormous powers and desires, a chaotic mass of unassimilated and intermixed mental, vital, and physical material of a larger existence which, because it is not taken up by a creative, harmonizing light of the spirit, must welter in a universalized confusion and discord out of which it is impossible to build a greater harmonic life. Man has harmonized life in the past by organized ideation and limitation. He has created societies based on fixed ideas or fixed customs, a fixed cultural system, or an organic life system, each with its own order. The throwing of all these into the melting pot of a more and more intermingling life and a pouring in of ever new ideas and motives and facts and possibilities call for a new, a greater consciousness to meet and master the increasing potentialities of existence and harmonize them. Reason and science can only help by standardizing, by fixing everything into an artificially arranged and mechanized unity of material life. A greater whole being, whole knowledge, whole power is needed to weld all into a greater unity of whole life.
So here you see he's pointing out how in a way our civilization is really dominating us to a much greater extent than we imagine, because it has sort of escaped from our control. It's too huge. And that's indeed the whole sort of, actually right from, let's say, around the 1960s, this fact has become very predominant in global earthly civilization, world civilization, that our world changes are being dominated or determined by technological changes that are synergistic and that nobody can predict. See, it's not that mankind has control over the drift of our civilization. Things are changing in our world due to effects, very accelerated effects of machinery. And this machinery is both machinery of commerce and machinery of technology. Both the things are compounded to create the world in which we live and push it in directions that we have no control over. This is happening on the one end, and on the other end, as far as the individual is concerned, this tremendous kind of a machine without a driver in its kind of cockpit or whatever its driving station is essentially universalizing itself so that individuals are dwarfed and anonymized, and they are yet in have access to various of the levers of this universal machine. That's the part that he's talking about is also very dangerous, because at the individual level there is no sort of self-perfection, ideal of self-perfection or raising of the quality of consciousness, either to measure up to this enormous universality of the world in which we find ourselves, or to determine the direction in which this life is to flow. So, you know, some thinkers have talked about or given us the image of a monkey in a rocket ship cockpit with all these flashing buttons around and not knowing exactly what to push. All they push is based on their primitive desires. We have no idea what effects that's going to have on this very finely coordinated, intricate world machine that in any case we have no control over. So this is one of the big problems that he's talking about. Now, on the one hand, the whole idea of the industrial age, when it began, was that industry is going to ultimately be able to make it more convenient for the production of the necessities of life, so that once that was achieved, mankind would be released for leisure and creativity. You needn't slog throughout the day as the people in the past used to, because the same amount of work could be achieved through 2 hours of a machine. And then the rest of the time you had free to, enjoy yourself, and higher ideals would come and you would be able to move towards a higher life. Now, to some extent, this kind of original ideal of industry is what alternate societies have tried to hold up. To some extent, we may say that this is the ideal of the Sri Aurobindo Ashram or of Aurobindo. To some extent, this is the ideal of Shantiniketan and also of Gandhi's ashram. Because the whole notion was that we can determine how much we need collectively, and we can produce that using the devices available at our command, and then utilize the rest of our time to grow towards goals that are higher, goals of consciousness and creativity. But on the other hand, what has resulted, as he says over here, that over here, this new fullness of the means of life might be, by its power for a release from the incessant, unsatisfied stress of his economic and physical needs, an opportunity for the full pursuit of other and greater aims, surpassing the material existence, for the discovery of a higher truth and good and beauty, for the discovery of a greater diviner spirit, which would intervene and use life for a higher perfection of the being. But it is being used instead for the multiplication of new wants and an aggressive expansion of the collective ego. So instead of that, what this entire much more powerful, sort of productive capacity has yielded is the creation, the whole machinery to create desire in human beings and to create more surplus of these productions, so that mankind is put more and more to work and also forced to, consume much more than he had need for to start with. So this becomes the way by which a certain kind of a self-fulfilling, prophecy is set in motion, and there is it's like a treadmill. One can't get out of it because it takes on a life of its own beyond a certain point. And mankind has no control over it and doesn't have the consciousness to deal with it.
Devashish,
Yes.
In the 60s was also, of course, the big upsurging of Madison Avenue and their powerful influence. And there's even a show on television called Mad Men. And that term, Mad Men, was from Madison Avenue, but it also shows at the beginning credits of the show, a man from Madison Avenue killing himself, jumping out of a window from a skyscraper building in New York. And that indeed did happen. And I know that, well, I was kind of there, and it was just like the show on TV. But there was this tremendous conflict within these men and women working in advertising at that time on Madison Avenue. The thing of just selling products and getting people to stirring up desire for these things that you maybe didn't believe in, or the particular brand of what you were paid to tell people to buy you didn't believe in. Just a very fascinating time, and I'm sure it fits in here somewhere, but yeah,
there's no doubt. Yeah, exactly. But now you see, even that is not really necessary, because our methods of selling have become so sophisticated that we are just saturated in desire-making schemes. You know, that's the air we breathe, in fact. That's the massage of the times. As McLuhan says, you know, the medium is the massage.
Yes. How do you mean the air we breathe?
Well, I mean in a figurative sense, but it may be more literal than figurative, because I mean that, you know, geography and whatever we call natural is all in some sense given a spin, which is a sort of a commercial spin.
Oh, like water, drinking water.
Like drinking water, or, I mean, generally, you know, innocuously, we are being sort of given all these messages constantly, which are trying to convince us of this, that, or the other.
Yes.
Create desire, basically, in some thing or the other.
Churning desire.
Vince, will you read next?
Sure. A life of unity, mutuality, and harmony, born of a deeper and wider truth of our being, is the only truth of life that can successfully replace the imperfect mental constructions of the past, which were a combination of association and regulated conflict. An accommodation of egos and interests, grouped or dovetailed into each other to form a society, consolidation by common general life motives, a unification by need in the pressure of struggle with outside forces. It is such a change and such a reshaping of life for which humanity is blindly beginning to seek, now more and more, with a sense that its very existence depends upon finding the way. The evolution of mind, working upon life, has developed an organization of the activity of mind and use of matter which can no longer be supported by human capacity without an inner change. In accommodation of the egocentric human individuality, separative, even in association, to a system of living which demands unity, perfect mutuality, harmony, is imperative. But because the burden which is being laid on mankind is too great for the in its petty mind, in small life instincts, because it cannot operate the needed change, because it is using this new apparatus and organization to serve the old, infra-spiritual, and infra-rational life self of humanity. The destiny of the race seems to be heading dangerously, as if impatiently, and in spite of itself, under the drive of the vital ego, seized by colossal forces which are on the same scale as the huge mechanical organization of life and scientific knowledge, which it has evolved, a scale too large for its reason and will to handle, into a prolonged confusion and perilous crisis and darkness of violent, shifting incertitude. Even if this turns out to be a passing phase or appearance in a tolerable structural accommodations bound, which will enable mankind to proceed less catastrophically on its uncertain journey, this can only be a respite. For the problem is fundamental, and in putting it, evolutionary nature in man is confronting herself with a critical choice which must one day be solved in a true sense if the race is to arrive or even to survive. The evolutionary nisus is pushing towards a development of the cosmic force in terrestrial life which needs a larger mental and vital being to support it, a wider mind, a greater, wider, more conscious, unitized life soul, anima. And that again needs an unveiling of the supporting soul and spiritual self within to maintain it.
So again, a very, very powerful paragraph in which he brings this entire idea into its fullness, I think, because exactly he points out that this enormous kind of material civilization that has been created, dynamic machine, we may say, not merely a static kind of civilization of choiceless structures, but something with movement to it, is ultimately being driven by a colossal vital self or ego here that is far beyond the human. So it's like there are these major asuric powers that have been unleashed, a mental asura and a vital asura, you know, these two large cosmic level asuras are driving the wheels of the world and taking us for a ride. And the human being is given this situation has been provided to the human being, as it were, to make something of it and to arrive at a solution to the problem. But first, there has to be a waking up to what's going on. So long as this condition is one we take for granted, or even we take as a happy condition, the condition of life to live or to be in, the only condition there is, there can be no solution. And we are back to the point that he was talking about, where either we'll end up as something that will go extinct due to reliance on these very forces, ultimately destroying us, leading us to the brink, or else to be bypassed by the evolution because we'll be stultified, fossilized as a species, unable to develop the evolutionary power of consciousness to make sense of our civilized situation. And that's the problem of the present. That's the real problem of the present. And he's pointing out that, you know, in his time, this is being written in the 1950s, mind you, in the wake of the Second World War. And in that state, in that condition, there are two things that are going on. One is a tremendous depression of the world consciousness. The Second World War left the world with a sense of, you know, tremendous, you know, lack of capacity, incapacity. The whole, at one particular level, at a certain level of human, idealism, it yielded a bankruptcy, because there was the knowledge, the sense that mankind can do this to himself. That we as a race can push ourselves to the brink of disappearance, the brink of extinction. And just one more time, perhaps, we'll extinct ourselves. And there's no telling whether we will be able to avert the danger.
Vince? Excuse me. I mean, it's just that this paragraph is so, I see it as very prescient. I mean, it's written in the 50s, and you said to describe the events after World War II.
Right.
It just seems so completely descriptive of what's happening right now.
Yeah. But then the other side, so this is one aspect of this is one aspect of the post-war situation, this kind of sense of defeat. But the other aspect of the post-war situation was a certain kind of urgency, and that's what yielded the 60s, you may say, not only in America, but in terms of intellectual movements all over the world, in Europe, for example, in Germany and France, etc. There was a certain kind of ferment in which there was the sense that a breakthrough must take place. Mankind must emerge out of this. We have to be able to develop the powers of consciousness to emerge from this. But that's why he's saying over here, it is such a change and such a reshaping of life for which humanity is blindly beginning to seek, now more and more with a sense that its very existence depends on finding the way. See? Now, however, that urgency, that our very existence depends on finding the way, seems to have taken a back seat, though there is enough of a goad in life today with the kinds of situations that are arising that should make us feel that. But on the other hand, though some are perhaps experiencing that, the majority, I'd say, is under the influence of that kind of comfortable numbness that he's talking about. It's a sort of apathy which characterizes our present time. That is what neoliberal globalization is all about. We see, for example, the wars that are engaged with in these pathetic third world countries, or even worse, countries that are trying somehow to manage their, you know, economic lives. We see them basically in the same way as the Romans would sit in the Colosseum and see the spectacle. We do that because we turn on our TVs because it's far away from us. We lead apathetic lives in which we have nothing to do with what is going on somewhere else. Maybe we pass a few, you know, oohs and ahs about, you know, a few people are American soldiers dying in the war. But essentially, to the majority of the people of the first and second world particularly, and also I'd say most of the developing countries that are now rising in economy, this is a condition in which there is no urgency and no sense that we, you know, that our existence depends upon finding a way. I'm sorry to say it, but that's how I perceive our present time. And, you know, there is the other hand, you know, the rest of what he's saying over here is very much the condition. This infra-rational life of humanity, the destiny of the race seems to be heading dangerously, as if impatiently and in spite of itself, under the drive of the vital ego seized by colossal forces, which are on the same scale as the huge mechanical organization of life and scientific knowledge which it has evolved, a scale too large for its reason and will to handle, into a prolonged confusion and perilous crisis in darkness of violent shifting incertitude. Because as he points out, the only solution out of this condition is to recognize it first, to recognize the magnitude of the challenge and to be able to find the only solution that is adequate, which he ends that paragraph with, a wider mind, a greater, wider, more conscious, unanimized life soul, anima, and that again needs an unveiling of the supporting soul and spiritual self within to maintain it.
Yeah, Devin Shishin reminds me that that story you once told about the churning of the ocean, gods and the asherahs doing a tug of war with the snake of evolution and stirring up stuff. But now it seems like the gods and the asherahs don't, it seems like the gods, for instance, I mean, aren't even aware that there's a battle. It seems that recognition hasn't come.
Devashisda, are you there?
Oops, I guess I faded out.
No, you're there. I think Devashisda just went offline suddenly. Devashisda, are you here? We'll just give it a second.
Yeah,
sorry, Devashisda. I'm not sure if you got Vince's question. Vince, maybe you can repeat it.
Did you get what I said, Devashisda?
I just got the first part. You were saying it reminds you of the story of the churning of the ocean.
Yes.
That's all that.
Yeah, I mean, with the, you know, the gods and the asherahs had that tug of war with the snake of evolution and as the rope. But now there seems to be, it seems to be at that point. That seems very descriptive of the world. But there's no need. Well, there's no need, like, for the. It seems like there's no recognition of the fact that there needs to be that kind of tug of war between the gods and the asuras to.
Yeah. Now, yeah. There's a few possibilities that one can think of here. One thing that I think of sometimes is that, you know, when Sri Aurobindo was writing and when he and the mother were in the body.
Yes.
Tremendous, powerful force was active in the world, and this kind of, you know, evolutionary possibility was very strong and urgent. And perhaps what has happened as a result of their leaving the body is that the forces have become diffuse, and now they are no longer, I mean, it's almost like, it's something like a kind of tremendous pressure being put for a certain process to break through. But then the pressure being removed And then the process has slowed down as a result. It has become more diffuse. And this is one possibility I'm saying, that then, and then what happens is that essentially what could have been achieved right there and then is now left for posterity with a big question mark on it. And the answer to whether it will be achieved or not is really then left to humanity. I mean, it's completely now that whoever wants to pursue it is given the choice, to the freedom and the choice to pursue it. Others are given the freedom to deny it. This is one scenario that I can think of. The other scenario is more bleak, which is essentially that the same amount of urgency is there, but we have lost the perception completely, to a large extent, and now are like blinded flocks being driven without being able to engage with the enormity of the situation in which we find ourselves.
Sitaram, can you read next? Are you there, Sitaram?
Yes, just one moment. Society and the democratic cultus of the average man are all that the modern mind presents us in this crisis as a light for its solution. Whatever the truth supporting these ideas, this is clearly not enough to meet the need of humanity, which is mission to evolve beyond itself. Or, at any rate, if it is to live, must evolve far beyond anything that it at present is. The life instinct in the race and in the average man himself has felt the inadequacy and has been driving towards a reversal of values or a discovery of new values and a transfer of life to a new foundation. This has taken the form of an attempt to find a simple and ready-made basis of unity, mutuality, harmony for the common life, to enforce it by a suppression of the competitive clash of egos, and so to arrive at a life of identity for the community in place of a life of difference. But to realize this desirable ends, the means adopted have been the forcible and successful materialization of a few restricted ideas or slogans and thrown to the exclusion of all the other thought, the suppression of the mind of the individual, a mechanized compression of the elements of life, a mechanized unity and the drive of the life force, the coercion of man by the state, the substitution of communal for the individual ego. The communal ego is idealized as the soul of the nation, the race, the community. But this is a colossal and may turn out to be a fatal error. A forced and imposed unanimity of mind, life, action rise to their highest tension under the drive of something which is thought to be greater, the collective soul, the collective life, is the formula found. But this obscure collective being is not the soul or self of the community. It is a life force that rises from the subconscious, and if denied the light of guidance by the reason, can be driven only by dark, massive forces, which are powerful but dangerous for the race because they are alien to the conscious evolution of which man is the trustee and the bearer. It is not in this direction that evolutionary nature has pointed mankind. This is a reversion towards something that she had left behind her.
So this is, of course, the socialist ideal and the collectivist ideal or the fascist ideal. All these are various kinds of forced unanimities at the collective level, driven by either ideology or by some kind of slogan, as he's saying. That's the whole idea of fascism, which tries to force a people under a certain kind of national or other form of infrarational identity. This is actually the Second World War had raised in a very major manner these fascistic forces. Now, we may say that the aftermath of that war still left some of these vibrations behind. Sri Aurobindo himself, the strength with which he is expressing this has not only acted against it in his writing, but one may say has been very active against this kind of a false collectivist idea in his own occult action. And therefore, one may say that not only these fascistic ideas, but even the collectivist ideas of state socialism have been contested by him and opposed by him, both in writing as well as through his own force. Today, as a result, these kind of forces, at least of the past, seem to be less dangerous than other kinds of forces. For one, maybe the fascistic force is on the rise today in the shape of an infrarational religious urge or national religionisms or religious nationalisms, however you want to call it, that are sweeping the world today. So that is one level at which this kind of problem is still present. The seeds of it are still present and little understood by the mass of humanity. But other problems have arisen that are even more dangerous in today's world than these ones that he perhaps thought were so important and so powerful in his own time. And perhaps he himself has been at least partly responsible for defusing their action. This particular paragraph is more about fascism, I'd say. The next paragraph is more about collectivist communism or socialism, where there is an economic equality that is imposed on peoples.
Devasudha, did you want to stop here, or did you want to read more, or it's past 9, it's 9:10, so...
Let's read one more, because then this thought will
sure.
The idea will be continued in the next. It's a small paragraph.
Okay. Sure. Bindu, are you there? Would you like to read next?
Another solution that is attempted reposes still on the materialistic reason and the unified organization of the economic life of the race. But the method that is being employed is the same, of forced compression and imposed unanimity of mind and life, and a mechanical organization of the communal existence. A unanimity of this kind can only be maintained by compression of all freedom of thought and life. And that must bring about either the efficient stability of a termite civilization or a drying up of the springs of life and a swift, a slow decadence. It is through the growth of consciousness that the collective soul and its life can become aware of itself and develop. The free play of mind and life is essential for the growth of consciousness. For mind and life are the soul's only instrumentation until a higher instrumentation develops. They must not be inhibited in their action or rendered. The difficulties or disorders engendered by the growth of the individual. The true cure can only be achieved by its progression to a greater consciousness in which is fulfilled and perfected.
So that is the state idea, the state socialist idea, essentially, that he's talking about over here. And indeed, one may say that when Sri Aurobindo was writing this, this was the greater danger that was looming, because the Second World War ends with the development of the Soviet bloc and the initiation of what is known as Cold War, and communist nations of Southeast Asia and East Asia that Sri Aurobindo was in the thick of during the last years of his life. And these were the difficulties to some extent that he was dealing with at the political level in his own time, at the time when he was writing this.
So Devashita, does it propose a solution to this current situation for the town?
Well, so far he is leaving us with this situation, and the solution he has already proposed. The solution is essentially, like he said earlier, that individual consciousness, the new ideals have to come, in which we see the fact that these are inadequate solutions, and individual consciousness has to make its bid to increase, widen the mind, widen the life soul, and bring the inner spirit, the divine spirit, to the front. However we call these things, I mean, what terms we use for these things is not important. What is important is, first and foremost, that there is recognized the fact that humanity has the capacity to expand its consciousness, to come into grips with whatever is driving us right now, to discipline ourselves, and to change the direction of civilization, to steward civilization towards a higher consciousness. These ideals must arrive, and that's the point he's making, that in today's world we find that the ideals that are universalizing themselves in the world ultimately these ideals are also universalizing themselves through leaders and through people. I mean, fascism can only establish itself because there are fascist leaders, and the mass listens to these leaders. Similarly, communism has managed to wreak havoc due to people like Stalin and Mao Zedong and Pol Pot. So the whole idea is that the right leaders have to arise, and the training and education has to be given to the people, so that people can, in that sense, be open to these ideas. But unless that happens, our capacity is tremendously stymied, because the general person does not even believe that there is something like a power of consciousness. So this is exactly why Sri Aurobindo has said the only way that the future can be opened up is by bringing yoga into the common ground. You know, it has to, the way of yoga has to be open to mankind. That is hardly being done, you see. I mean, if we look at it from the viewpoint of the time that Sri Aurobindo was from, let's say, from the turn of this great revolutions in modern times have taken place at the turn of the 19th and 20th century. And just as we may say that each sort of race or nation or people was giving their best at that time, we see in Western history books the names of people like Einstein on the one hand, and other, from Germany you had great philosophers and great scientists, and from France, for example, you had great artists. But what is often lost is that this is the same time that India produced these tremendous figures, these hero souls, you may say, like Vivekananda and Sri Aurobindo and Rabindranath Tagore and people like that, who were being those kind of leaders that could shape the thought of the world in this direction. But nobody has followed in their wake. Today, India is a second-rate mind power. The only thing that India is contributing to the world is computer programmers. I mean, there's no power of thought that is going out to open up the doors of the future to the world. We are only following what others are doing, and only being what are called serfs of the world industry. So this is one of the reasons why I would say we are in the situation in which we find ourselves. There hasn't arisen any kind of attempt after that of, say, the 1940s or so, of the 1950s, and this entire generation that we are talking about passed away, there hasn't arisen anything of a comparable, power of mind or thought or of vision that has arisen in the world.
It's in a way it has become kind of very very centralized. No, it is not that, like, from the outer perspective it doesn't seem like there are a variety of thoughts that are dominating the world, but that it has, the world has become, you know, in a way singular in thought. Maybe there are, you know, fringe things like maybe there are a variety of thoughts that are being addressed in maybe there are a variety of thoughts that are addressed in academia, but in practical life it's almost like the idea of free market capitalism has just completely overtaken the world, right? So it's India, but
that's what neoliberal globalization is all about. It's and that's what we were talking about. It's the state where the world is swept by these ideas as being the perfectibility of life. You know, this is it. That's what people like, you know, Francis Fukuyama called the end of history. That's exactly what he's talking about. That kind of condition will be the end of the evolutionary nisus. you know, that would ultimately create an entire world of people, of a humanity that crystallizes itself into the idea that we've achieved whatever it is that is possible to human beings. Nothing more is possible. Now we can just go around in circles doing what has been set up. This is the setup. And there's nothing more to be taught because this is life. See, and that is in a sense the end of, like he called it, the end of history. It's really the end of human possibility. And then the only thing that can happen is that either something drastic happens and we destroy ourselves, or we get sidetracked and some sort of being takes over the next step of the evolution.
Which was what he was saying in the first paragraph that we read today, right?
Right.
That, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Right. One second. You must call off at this point because I have somebody waiting for me downstairs. So
sure,
maybe we can have a short meditation and end here.
Sure, let's end with a brief meditation.